into that.
Could you talk about, you mentioned how, you know, when you start, you try the new seeds and that your friend gave you these seedlings and it came from a fruit. Can you kind of talk about the importance of seeds? And I mean, just all of this was inspired by the Seed Sovereignty conferences. So I don't know, can you talk about the importance of seeds? And I mean, you also talked about the seeds that that Oñate brought and this, you know, just saving seeds. And you talked about your grandma, just, you know, or your mom, I'm sorry. Yeah. Could you talk about the importance of the seeds and what, just, you know, what that.
Well, I think the seeds are like the land. They have their own memory, you know. They know how to grow. They know where they'll grow, you know. They know where they come from. That's why when you plant a seed, you know, the memory there of that seed or within that seed tells it how much water it's going to need to grow, how much sunshine, how much cold it'll be able to endure, or heat. You know, that's all part of the genetic code that's embedded in that seed. And if we lose those seeds, we lose a lot of knowledge about the land, about what that seed really represents. You know, we don't think about it, you know. And that's why Monsanto and these corporations are aware of, and they're trying to trademark everything that they can so that they can exploit it and make money, you know, the seeds or animals. Though we do it also, every time you plant a seed, it might cross-pollinate with other seeds. We're always also involved in modifying that seed. But we don't do it so drastically that we remove some type of you know, what the seed has inside from a totally different type of seed or other being, and implanting in that particular seed of corn or chili or what it might be, or from a cow to a sheep or whatever, you know, we just, whatever the wind brings and takes, you know. And but I think that if we lose our seeds, we're going to lose a lot of the genetic diversity that still exists here in northern New Mexico. It's probably one of the few areas in the country where there's so much diversity, you know, with all the different wild grasses, the corns that are still available in some of the attics and some of the old tin cans that old people have throughout northern New Mexico, in Peñasco, Chamizal, in Embudo, in Cuesta, in San Luis. You know, they have a lot of really valuable genetic stuff there that I hope people don't throw it away, you know. And the same with the trees, you know. If you cut a tree, I know sometimes you have to cut them because you're doing some work there. But what can be done is, like I mentioned a while ago, you know, save some of the wood and then graft it into and create a new tree. That way you might get rid of the old tree because it's also dying. But you also save that particular variety of fruit. And what we're seeing also is that, you know, and I think as farmers, they're probably not even against some type of genetic modification, as long as it's not so excessive that it changes completely what the original seed was, you know, because there's always experimentation going on. There's always things that are going to be changing. You know, you cannot keep everything the same as it is. And I think corn is a perfect example, you know. If the Indians of Mesoamerica had not experimented with corn, there would not be so many different varieties. But they experimented with corn with different colors, at different sizes. You know, I was in Chiapas last May, and just to see the diversity of the crops that they have there. You know, I was in one of the markets there, and I was talking to this man. I had never seen so many varieties of beans, and he said he had 40, and he said, oh, this is nothing. You should come around December. I usually have about 100 different types of beans at that time. a lot of different chilies I had not seen before, you know. Corn's the same thing. And here, if you go to the store, even the stores at Whole Foods or other stores that are supposed to be more in tune with what's going on with the organic farming and with the preserving the diversity, you know, you're lucky if you find 5 or 6 different types of apples. Peach is the same thing, you know. Lettuce may be 4 or 5 at the most, you know. Yet there's hundreds of different varieties. At one time, there were about 10,000 varieties of apples. Now they say that they're probably down to 2,000. In New Mexico, one time that I was doing some research in the archives, it said that up to the 1940s, there were about 400 different apples in New Mexico. I don't know how many there are now, but I think would be surprised if we would find 200 varieties. Because again, when you go to the store, which are the ones that you find? Double Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, maybe Jonathan. Now you might find some Fuji's and Granny Smith and a few others, you know, that are more supposedly exotic. Peaches, maybe 1 or 2 types. Pears, the same thing, you know, maybe the Bartlett and a red pear, you know. So, you know, and so kids that are growing nowadays have no clue as to the diversity of fruits that might be available. Every apple has a different taste. Every peach has a different taste. Every lettuce, the same thing, you know, the taste, the texture, the design of the leaves, the color, you know, they're all different, you know. And I think it's not fair for the kids that are being born today that we're not taking care of this diversity, you know, that instead of creating more diversity, we're cutting down on the diversity. And we're partly at fault, like I said, you know, because if we see something new, we don't try it. If we see a new corn, we don't try it because we're used to having one type of corn. The same thing with the chilies, you know, or with the fruits. Introduce new fruits and they'll be there in the market for a long time and very few people will buy them. So as a result, the store owner is going to say, well, you know, I tried these new varieties of Asian pears and nobody bought them. I lost them all, so I'm here to make a living. I'm not going to buy any more Asian pears. I'll buy the Bartletts that people are familiar with and they buy them, even if they don't have taste. The same thing with the apples, you know, the Golden Delicious are not the tastiest apples. Well, the ones that we grow here are a lot different than the ones you get at the store. But still, if you take an apple from here that's not completely double red, as they are called, you know, people will not buy them because they'll think that they're green. You take a new variety of apple that's kind of greenish, they think that it's not unripened because it has a color green. So it's all a marketing thing that we're dealing with now, you know. And I don't know how we're going to solve that challenge there, you know, about getting people to try different fruits and different cuisines, you know. Because instead of experimenting more, we're cutting more, you know. And that's why I say, you know, some of the things that they might be doing with experimentation in some of the university farms, experimental stations might be okay, but I think they just can't release them out to everybody and then contaminate all the seeds or tell you, well, you can't use your traditional seeds because you have to buy from me because now I have trademarked that seed that used to belong to your ancestors, to your grandfather, your great-grandfather. Now it's under Monsanto's name, and now if you want to use it, you have. That's one of the things I don't like, you know, that they're forcing you to buy only from them. And once they control all the genetic diversity, then we're screwed. Because then, if I want to plant some corn to make chicos or pozole, I have to go buy it from them. And they might say, oh, okay, now I'll sell you $10 per seed. And then I won't be able to afford to buy it. Then I have to buy everything from them also, the way they do their own pozole and their own chicos, which should be totally different from the way we do it, because they're going to be doing it for a mass market. Instead of having a small horno where you might make 10, 15 pounds of chicos, it's going to be done in an oven that might be making 2,000 or 5,000 pounds of corn at one time, you know, and the taste is not going to be the same. So for me, that's the importance of preserving our own seeds, you know. And we trade them. We trade them among the different. My mother always used to trade chili seeds because she said we should always get new chili seed every 5 years, and get chili seed that's grown with different waters from different watersheds. She would trade with my aunts that live in the Wicca area, you know, from the seed that was grown there with the water from the Rio Grande, or seed from people that were growing from the Santa Cruz area that were watering with a river from Santa Cruz, or from the Rio Chama, you know. People always knew that you could never keep the same seed forever and ever, you know, that you had to exchange it. And if somebody would have some chili that was hotter or less hot or bigger, you know, people would say, well, I like that chili, you know, because not everybody likes chili that's very hot. So they would always be experimenting with different chilies, you know, mixing a little bit of this chili with this chili and planting it and see what it would produce. And it would undoubtedly produce a new variety.
Could you talk about, I know you already, you know, you had said that like in the fiestas you always find the arroz con leche and that's, you know, that comes from everything. Is there any example that you have of like a festival, a fiesta, or just anything that is part of New Mexico culture that comes from the land?
Well, I think all the food that was originally served in fiestas, and for that matter in the daily food we eat, everything came from the land. It's not until recently, in the past 30 years, more so in the past 10 years, and more so in the last year, that it's less and less from the land here, and it's grown somewhere else. You know, that's why I'm not that much of an advocate of simply eating organic for the sake of organic, because if you're buying something that's produced 10,000 miles from here, just because it's organic, you're not doing the earth any favor by buying organic from something that's grown in Chile. I'd rather the same thing as apples. Maybe my neighbor might use some pesticides in spraying his apples, but they're from right here across the fence. I'd rather eat an apple from his orchard that he has sprayed than to buy an organic apple that comes from Washington State or Missouri or Illinois. It makes no sense, you know. All the spent fossil fuel to transport the apple. You know, the other day I found some white asparagus at the store, and I bought them because when I travel to Spain, I really like them. You know, they have a totally different taste than the other asparagus. And I just bought them just to see the difference in the taste, you know. And they didn't taste at all like the white asparagus that I've tasted when I've traveled in Spain that's grown right there. You know, they were almost inedible. Though they looked beautiful and they looked great, you know, but they didn't have taste. They were hard to eat, you know. They had to throw about half of the asparagus because you couldn't eat it, you couldn't chew it. So for, you know, before all the fiestas that were, very little was bought from the store. I think the first grocery stores here in the area that I remember, the first grocery store in Española was called Fairview Foods in the mid-50s. There were mercantile stores, but they sold everything, you know, but they didn't sell any fresh food. You know, they sold just dried foods, you know, in bulk, beans, or because of people in the past, like us here, my parents, they would go selling fruit up to San Luis and Costilla, Amalia, Cuesta, and they would bring potatoes from over there. You know, they would bring maybe 2, 3 sacks of potatoes, which would be enough for the winter. And from here, they would trade with relatives that we had over there at that time for apples that we would take from here. You know, we'd take apples, and from over there, we'd bring potatoes, we'd bring stores that are the food stores that are available now are huge, you know, especially like the Walmart superstores. But I was reading the other day that there's really not much difference from the produce that you buy at Walmart or that you buy at Whole Foods. It's only that it's aimed towards a totally different market and marketed differently, you know. We don't know, you know, if it's organic. For me, the word organic doesn't mean anything anymore because now it's grown on huge conventional fields. Maybe they don't use pesticides, but look at what happened with the spinach last year. You know, they were organic, the ones that were found out to be contaminated. I think what needs to be done is grown locally and in small farms, 1 acre, 2 acres. And before, the communities would supply each other with what they needed, and it was more like a regional basis, you know, like from here to Mora to San Luis. People were able to survive for a long time by just exchanging among each other, you know, or through cambalache, you know, or the barter system. Now there's no barter system. Now everything is money and everything is profit. Everything. Now all the farmers, when you go to a farmers conference, they're all they talk about. They talk more about the business aspect, about profit, than they talk about food or farming, because that's what they're concerned with, you know. If they don't make a profit, I've seen so many people come through the Embudo Valley that wanted to be farmers, and but the first thing they were concerned with, well, how much money am I going to make, and can I survive? And after 2, 3 years, they haven't survived economically, so they move on to another career. And those of us that are traditional, we have remained here because what I plant or what I grow and the trees that I have, I don't even think about it in an economic terms. It's for me, for my family, and for friends and relatives that I grow, the food that we grow and the trees that I have. You know, if I was to look at it from an economic point of view, I wouldn't be doing it because I'm losing money. But that's not the reason I do what I do. I do it because it's part of who I am and because I enjoy doing it, and not because of an economic incentive that I'm gonna become rich, or at least or that I'm even gonna be able to survive. I have to find other ways of making a living, but it's just for being able to be outside exercising, and then for even for a short period of time of just tasting what a real fruit tastes like, you know, what a real peach, what a real apricot, a real green chili, or a corn, just go and pluck it from the plant and bring it inside. I have some asparagus. Even in that book that I did on the other volume that we're working on, it says there about the asparagus that the best way to eat the asparagus is just to go into the field where you're growing them, make a fire there, and cook them right there and eat them. Well, of course, that's what I try to do here. You know, my asparagus, I bring them in 5 minutes before we're gonna cook them. And you can't compare the taste that those asparagus have with the ones you buy at the store. Even if they're brought in from California, by the time they get here, they're probably 10 days old that they have been harvested. Those ones that I told you about, the white asparagus that I bought, they were from Peru. And I bought them. I knew I was just for an experiment, just to see the difference in the taste, and then if they tasted like the white asparagus that I have eaten that are freshly harvested. So, you know, because you buy things at Whole Foods, that tells you only one thing, that you have money that you can afford to buy there. It doesn't mean that you're getting better produce than those of us poor people that buy at Walmart or at Raley's or at other supermarkets. The same thing as the farmer's markets, you know. I support the farmer's market, but what we're seeing is that it's turning community member against community member, because they're competing. They're there to sell. And sometimes people, if they can't sell something, they'll cut down on their prices to undersell their neighbor. And that creates tension in the local community. And again, who are the ones that go to the farmer's market? The rich people. The average income of the people in Santa Fe is $75,000. You know, so the poor people, even at the farmer's market here in Dixon, some people come and try to sell potatoes for $2 a pound. Well, you know, that's $200 for a 100-pound sack that you can buy for $10, you know, so it makes no sense economically, the local people cannot buy there, because if your income is $15,000 or $20,000 a year, you're going to be looking for bargains. You're not going to pay a dollar for an onion that's grown organically and grown local. You know, for you, that's an abstraction. It makes no sense. You have to figure out, you have $100 to spend for the week for food. Are you going to spend it by buying 10 pounds of potatoes at $2? That's $20. You buy two onions at $1 an onion, that's $2. Before you know it, you spent half in a little bag that you'll bring back home. So, okay, maybe you go to Walmart or Lowe's Super Save or some other store where you can bring more food for your family. And a lot of times it has to do how you cook the food too, you know. If you're a good cook, I think if you know how to cook, you can make even a piece of cardboard taste okay, you know. And if you're a terrible cook, you might pay $10 for one potato and it's still going to taste bad. So for me, you know, it's a lot about marketing what food has become about now, you know. All the fast food places that are sprouting like mushrooms everywhere, you know, in Taos, in Espanol, that's all you see. And that's what the kids are buying into, you know. They're not going to, very few people have the luxury of going to a good restaurant like Antonio's in Taos or Joseph's Table, because you can't afford it. And kids are not going to go there because their parents never took them there. So if you have two or three kids that are growing up, maybe what you'll do is you'll stop at Sonic or at Kentucky Fried Chicken and buy a basket of a fat there, you know, that's called chicken, of what I call retired chickens that are 20 years old, you know, they make them palatable and edible, and that's what the majority of the people eat. And that's why we're also having a lot of problems, I think, with our health. Because we're not eating healthy. And that's one of the reasons I keep my sheep there, because I like lamb and I can't afford it. And though probably it's more expensive that I have my sheep than if I was to buy lamb when we want to eat lamb, but at least I know what I'm eating. We butcher them here, you know. I know a lot of the people from the animal rights movement are against people eating meat because of the of how you what do you call them, the violence, you know, of butchering an animal. You know, don't tell me about violence. It's, we live in the most violent world, in the most violent country in the world, you know. We invade other countries, we go kill them, we destroy them, we talk about violence, you know. I'm all for protecting animals. I love my animals. I love my pets. I wouldn't hurt them. But don't tell me about violence if I kill one of my sheep for meat, because I'm going to use it to nourish my body and to nourish the bodies of my family, you know. Doesn't matter, like, if you use a taser to first immobilize the animal and you have to cut the neck, it's the same thing, you know. Death is death, you know. What tells me that an onion, or when you pull it from, pluck it from the ground, doesn't feel? Or a lettuce, when you cut it, that it doesn't feel, you know? We don't know. It's still death to that particular plant. So what then? We're not going to eat anything because we don't want to do any violence to anything on earth. We wouldn't be driving. Then we would have to become hermits and just go into a cave and stay there. And that's all, you know. That's a bunch of BS when they say about violence, you know, about the animals. I know that the more, when you have factory farms, probably the animals do suffer more. But what I'm, again, it's going back to small and local, you know. If you have your own chickens and you butcher them, you're going to have to kill them somewhere or another to eat them. If it's fish, the same way, you know. I have still to see anybody eating live meat. You know, just say I want a hamburger, I want a steak, or I want a shrimp or whatever, just eating it live as it is, you know. You have to kill that animal. There's no way you're going to eat it alive. Even an apple, if you're going to, you have to pluck it from the tree and bite into it. I don't know if it feels pain. Nobody has ever done any type of research to see what pain that apple feels when you bite into it and say, oh, that's wonderful. What a marvelous taste that apple has, or that salad, you know. So I think a lot of it is just where you are born and where you're raised, you know. And those of us that are raised on the land and have been here, we look at animals, at food, with a totally different color lens that someone that has lived all their life in New York, in a big apartment building, that have never had any contact with their food, and all of a sudden move to Taos or to Embudo, and they want to become organic farmers, and they want to tell me how to grow the food and how I should do it, you know. For me, it doesn't, I don't buy it, you know.